My name is Dawn, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I am an old timer. You know, I never thought that day would come, you know? I can remember when my husband and I came into this fellowship, we were always the youngest people. You know, we took great joy, we took great pride. I remember when Peter was quite disgusted when somebody else came younger than he. And all the concentration of the group went over to him. No, but that's what it's about. It's about growing and staying and developing. I'd like to say that I've been here for 44 years in November, and I'd like to say I understand it all. I've got it all. I don't need to go to meetings anymore, but I'm sorry, you know. I need meetings now more than ever. The more you grow and the more you learn and the more you know, the more you realize how little you know. But if you keep coming back, more will be revealed. That's the good news. So that says that even though I'll be 71 in November, I will continue to grow. I think that's such good news. I want to thank Glenna for meeting me at the airport and being so gracious to me. And all the people in Al-Anon that I sat around the rooms with today and last night. And the fellowship that is as alive here as it is in Chicago, as it is in Reston, Virginia, where I used to live, as it is in upstate New York, as it is in Detroit, where I came in. You know, I am one of the slowest learners in this program. And so anyone here who's having a hard time getting this program, the good news is just keep coming back. Not so long ago, before I moved to Chicago, I had been traveling a little bit and talking here and there, and I looked at my home group, and I hadn't been there for about 4 weeks in a row, and there was a newcomer there, and she came up to me, and she said, "Are you new?" And I said, "No." And she said, "How long have you been coming?" And at that time, I said, "I've been here about 40 years. And she said, "You must really be sick." I said, "Well, you know, it's all in how you look at it." She was certainly smarter than she thought she was. "Yes, I really am sick. The good news is I'm getting better. The even better news is I have a path. I didn't have this path. I have a path that I can follow. And if I follow that path and live by that path, every situation in my life will be solved. Not with my help, but with the help of my higher power. My job is to show up. My job is to give service. And my job is to be loving. It's really very simple. Now, you think that I can do that all the time? But more times than not, it works. When I came into this program, my husband had been sober about, I went to a psychiatrist. My little son, that's been about 14, he was having problems getting his life together. And the psychiatrist wanted to talk to his parents. And so Peter and I went there. We were looking very good that day, my husband in his business suit. I had just gotten off of work, and I was looking like I knew what I was talking about, you know. So she said, "I want to know on a scale of 1 to 10 what kind of parenting you each received." So she looked at my husband, and my husband said, "On a scale of 1 to 10, I received about a 0 or a 1. And she looked at me, and I had my little Al-Anon crown kind of tucked to the side, you know. And she said, "What kind of parenting did you receive?" And I said, I would say about an 8 or 9. And she said, "It's you." She said, "No one who receives an 8 or 9 would marry someone who receives a 0 or a 1. She said, "You need to look at yourself." I was so angry. I mean, I was so angry. I remember going home, and I called my son, and I said, "Let me tell you something. Let me tell you what this woman said today. I've been sitting around these rooms a long time. Let me tell you what she said." And she said, "I've been telling you that all along." Now, she didn't have to say, she should have just said, anyway. You know, I came from a family that looked good. I call it fig trees. There's a story in the Bible about these fig trees that are over here blooming, you know, and they look like they've got fruit on them, and all the blossoms are out, you know, and then the master goes over to pick a blossom, and took a piece of the fruit, rather, and there's nothing there. It's just, you know, just blossom. Well, that's how we looked. People came to us all the time for wisdom and strength. Meanwhile, our kids were in the closet hiding because Peter and I were at one another's throats, just yelling, just fussing. The telephone would ring and I'd pick it up and say, is there anything I can do to be of help to you? Miss Al-Anon, you know, is there anything I can do? My family was in turmoil. My husband was sober. He had been sober for some years, you know. I was going to Al-Anon meetings. The family was sick. The family I grew up in was sick. My father was a bishop in the Methodist Church. What's good? What's good? No alcoholism whatsoever in my house. We were all compulsive eaters. We ate from the time we got up till the time we went to bed. I mean, sugar and flour substances just fed us, you know. And then we didn't stop there. I mean, if it just could move, we could eat it, you know. We'd have great church services, and these church services would be so high, people would be shouting and just so happy. The old Methodists shouted. I don't know what they do now, because I've been in so many religions since I've been in this program. I can't keep all that stuff. The good news is my faith, my life, my wholeness, and my relationship from God comes from these steps in these rooms. And I just visit other places because I like to hear people sing together and celebrate my higher power together. But my recovery comes in these rooms. But anyway, my family looked good, you know. Now, my grandfather, who died when I was about 6, had sexually abused me. So I had joined church from the time I was 6 on, trying to get cleaned up. I thought I was so dirty, so unclean. I just couldn't fit in anywhere because I was a 6-year-old child who had the feelings of an adult because I had experienced sexual abuse. Now, my grandfather wasn't a bad man. But he was a sick man, and I was angry from the time until I came in these rooms and worked that through. I also had an experience when my father was elected a bishop when I was, 12 years old, and we left that wonderful church. We had a church, my father had a church, this is in the early 40s, which was unheard of, a church that had at least 6,000 members. My father was an eloquent preacher. My father could, I would sit at his feet at any time. But he always preached occasionally, not always, but you know, let me say this. I'm in the program of Al-Anon, but my thinking is totally alcoholic. So I would not say seldom, always. That meant maybe once or twice. Okay. Preached about the prodigal child. And I always felt, you know, a prodigal child at 6 is kind of hard to do. You just can't be there. But that's the way I felt. I'm talking about feelings now. At this church, the people were very nice to me. I had a personality disorder long before I met my husband. I had a give-me thing. You know, like, it was your job to make me happy, because I was a depressed child. You should make me happy. It's always going to happen on the outside. Somebody out there was going to do something to make me happy. I used to go to church, and I'd carry a little purse about as big as the purse I have now, and I'd stuff it with Kleenex, and I'd stand at the end of the counter, at the end of the church altar, and I'd wait for people to come by and they'd speak to my father, ask them also to put a coin in my purse. I thought nothing of that. I mean, I thought that I was my father's child. They ought to do that. I would leave there with this purse full of money, which is a lot of money back then. You know, a purse full of money, didn't like pennies, never did like pennies. I'd have this, and then I would buy friends. Now, the reason I had to buy friends is my personality was so bad that people didn't want to be bothered with me. I mean, it was just, I had a personality disorder from the beginning. You know, it was just all about me. What are you going to do for me? How are you going to fix me? How are you going to make me happy? I felt bad about myself. But by the same token, I thought I deserved a whole lot of stuff. That's just who I was. That's who I was. Then I had this experience when I was about 16, 17 years old, when this choir director told me I could sing. And that was a pivotal moment in my life. I was going to be a star. There was no question about that. You know, I could sing. You know, everybody in my family could sing, so it wasn't a big deal. I mean, but it was a big deal to me. I can remember someone saying to my mother, oh, your daughter really could sing. She said, did you hear her sister? And I said, well, you're talking about me now, Mama, you know, but it was just, it was always somebody. Well, in the first place, my mother had 8 children. I was the last. By the time I came along, Mom and Dad were tired. You know? They used to say every time my dad built a church, my mother had a baby. So by the time I came along, Mama was tired. They were both tired.
So they built the Boston Church in Detroit, so that was the stopping of all the babies. But I was the last one. And Mom and Daddy were doing God's work. They really didn't have time for us kids anymore. They were busy telling the story, doing the good works of the church. And I always felt that nobody was there for me. There was always somebody there helping to take care of somebody. So I grew up with this little attitude, you know, a little attitude. But this man told me I could sing, and I was going to be a star. I was going to really sell this thing. Amazingly, I was singing in churches. Going to Mass, I wasn't that good. You know, but anyway, I was singing in churches. And you can connect with people in churches because you're singing from the bottom of my heart. I have always, always had a deep hunger to know God. Always. You know, I think now about all the times I tried to fill myself with foods and all the other kind of substances and so forth. It was because I hungered. It was deep inside me, this hunger for God, and I would connect with people. And this man, he gave me the solos, and I was really feeling like I was really something. I was this grossly obese child. I was the only one of my mother's children who I could just hang off these. My mother used to say, what are we going to put on us, you know, because they would always look nice, and here I came, and I either breaking out of whatever she fixed for me. I was just big, but this man said I was wonderful. And he took advantage of me one night on the way home from church. And I couldn't go in my house and tell my parents that you don't talk about those kind of things in my house. And 10 months later, I gave birth to a 10-pound, 4-ounce baby boy. I remember going to Women's Hospital in Detroit, Michigan. I remember going up to the admissions desk and saying, I have no doctor. I've seen no one, but I've been in labor for 2 days and I need help. And this man was standing next to me and he said, I don't know who she is. He said, but I'll be your doctor. And I delivered that baby, and they called my parents from the hospital. And I can imagine now what it must have been like for my mother and father. All they knew was that I was a fat kid. And they had to call them and say, come to your hospital, your daughter is here. And my father came to the hospital, and he said, we won't talk about it. He said, everything is all right. And I got this great sense of relief. And I remember leaving that hospital 2 days later, and we got to a stoplight. And a woman opened the door of the car and took the baby out of my arms and closed the door of the car. And we drove on. My father said, I'm a bishop in the church. My father said, I've lived an exemplary life before you. My father said, you get yourself together, young girl. He said, you've embarrassed me. You get yourself together. And you make something of your life. And I remember screaming and crying. I remember going from one church to another church looking for my baby, looking for the way his little hair grew in the back. And then one day I looked in the mirror and I said, there's only one thing wrong with me. I'm fat. If I fix the outside of me, everything will be all right. Now I thought that if you looked good, then something must be good inside. And so I found this diet doctor in Detroit, Michigan. His name was Dr. Weinstein. And he had this office over kind of a junkyard. And I remember taking a cab there and the cab driver said, young lady, I wouldn't take my dog to that doctor. And I said, neither would I. I'm going. And this doctor gave me diet pills. And he gave me stuff. And I would become a lunatic. I mean, I was a lunatic. I could be just run around. You know, I could do anything. Exercise. I was always a sedentary person. I was exercising. I would help clean up the house. I did all kind of stuff, you know. Well, in 9 months, this grossly obese, homely young woman turned into a stone fox. I mean, I was looking good. I don't mean I was looking a little bit good. I mean, I was really looking good. I mean, I looked so good that my brother said that I could ride in the front seat with him. Now, I mean, that's looking good. So I said, now, the only thing wrong with me is I need to find a husband. And see, if I find a husband, I can reduplicate. I can have children. You know, I can, now I'll be okay because this pain that's inside me that I don't talk about, that disappeared, you know, that will be all right now because I'm going to find somebody. Well, there was this wonderful young man who was pastoring a church in Pontiac, Michigan. And I was wondering, one day I'm going to be speaking somewhere. So I better come up and say, I know him. You know, because now he would be 78. But chances are, wherever you are, anyway, I have tried to find him to make amends, but my brother said the best amends he made to him was he didn't marry him. Anyway, he said that he had fallen deeply in love with me. He fell in love with the outside. He didn't know what was going on in here. No. He didn't know that in here these little tapes were going on saying, you're nothing, you know. You don't amount to anything. You're fooling all these people. You know, he didn't know that. He always saw was this gregarious, you know, looking person like I really am all together. And he said, will you marry me? And I said, yes. Well, there was this other young man who just, he had a job with the government. And he said, I'd fallen in love with you. And he said, will you marry me? And I said, yes. Now, there was this other young man who had just come home from the service, and he was kind of spacey. He really was kind of strange. I remember we were, he took me to places I'd never been before. I went with him to a bar. I'd never been to a bar before. And every time we went to a different bar, they called him. One bar said he was Dr. Crawford. The other bar said he was Attorney Crawford. So this guy is really bright, you know. I mean, he is really one of your top-notch intellect of the day, you know. We were standing at a bus stop because he didn't have a car. And he said to me, he said, Don, there's something I ought to tell you about myself. And I said, what is that? He said, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, isn't that romantic? All your great sisters are alcoholics, you know. This is really something. And then he said the magic words. He said, Don, I need you. What did you say? He said, I need you. I said, need me. He needs me. He said, I could be anything if I had you in my life. Oh, who do you think I married? You know, who do you think I married? You know, I had a mission. I had a destiny. Forget all my stuff. Don't even look at my dysfunction. Don't look at the home I came from. Don't look at the troubles I've been in my life on my own without the alcohol. That wasn't important. What's important is right now, I have a mission. Well, the mission didn't go quite like I expected it to go. I didn't know that alcohol got drunk. See, I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know that they would forget to bring the tape deck home. I didn't know that either. I didn't know that alcoholics do a lot of lying. I didn't know that, you know. I didn't know how undependable he was. I didn't, but the thing about it, as bad as he was, you see, he made me look good. You know what I mean? Now, I knew this man, he was truly my mission. I mean, he really made me look good because he was so dysfunctional. You know, I could at least get up out of the bed every day, right? I could at least cook. I mean, I didn't know how to cook much, but I could cook. I mean, I was just amazed at what a job I had. The problem was, after our first child was born, and he forgot I was in the hospital and didn't show up, and I had to call my dad to get money to get out of the hospital, after that little incident, he decided that he was going to call a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And don't you know, after being at my house, my little boy used to say, don't you know, I had been in the house for 3 days, and there was no food in the house. And here comes old Peter coming in. He had this quaint little habit. Every time he would get drunk, he would wet his pants. And so he'd been out for 3 days. You know, those pants for life. He took those pants, and they were standing over in the corner. And he called AA, and AA showed up on our doorstep in less than 3 or 4 hours. Now, I had called my preacher during that same time to tell him that I needed him to come and counsel us. And it had been 3 days since I called him, and he had not shown up yet. And remember, I'm the bishop's daughter. He should have been there, you know? But AA came for my husband. Now, my husband had had incidents. You know, the trouble with this is I've been in this program so long, and I'm so old that I can't get all the stories in there that are extremely important. So I'm kind of rushing this stuff, you know? My husband had been in AA way back, well, it was just before the traditions were signed into effect. My husband came into AA because he was sentenced there by his commanding officer in Georgia. Well, Georgia was totally segregated, and they wouldn't let him in the meeting. They made him sit inside the door and wouldn't let him in. And he went back week after week after week, and he was totally demoralized. But he kept going because he had to, or his commanding officer would have put him in the brig. So here, after those years, in 1956, when he knew he had hit his bottom, it's interesting the way God works. When he knew it is into Sodom, even though he had all that anger and resentment towards those people in those rooms, and he had fixed them for a few years, you know, he'd been out drinking and messing up, he called them, and this time, these guys ran to the door and helped Peter. And I remember standing in that house saying, who's going to come and get me? I'm the one in the house with the baby. I'm the one in the house alone. I'm the one in pain. Self-pity, self-pity, self-pity. Here I am. Who's going to come and get me? And they took Peter to a meeting. And I'd like to say that Peter immediately began working the steps, but he decided that he would work the first step and the 12th step. The man of his intellect didn't need the rest. And women called my house. I didn't like that. I didn't like that. So I decided that I was going to go to Al-Anon. Now, I'd like to give you a better reason for my going. I'd like to say that I thought I was sick. Mm-mm. I went to Al-Anon to see what was going on where my husband was concerned. And there wasn't an Al-Anon group where his home group was, so I went out to old Han and Y, and that was a good meeting out there, and I took about three or four lessons, and then I decided I was ready to start my own group because I had all this stuff up here. So where do you think I started my group? I started it right there where his group was. I heard someone in one of the meetings I went to say, so I could watch him and see what was going on. And I had a big book. We only had this little pamphlet. We didn't have the wonderful literature we had now. We had this little pamphlet that had a little blue book and had the steps on there. And I would read those steps and underline all the places where I could really help him. And my girlfriend said to me, you know what we should do? Is that we should come to the meeting and we could lay down in the back seat of our car, cover ourselves up, and then when Peter gets in the car to go home, I will find out whether he's going home with other women. You know. And I said, this is the most brilliant idea I've ever heard in my life. And so I asked her to be my sponsor. Needless to say, my recovery was rather slow, you know. But we were helping one another. It was the blind leading the blind. We were helping one another. I remember once they asked me to give a prayer at one of the, it was like the big annual Michigan meeting. And it was like asking a babbling idiot to get up there. I don't know what I said, if I said anything. You know, people say, keep coming back. I mean, that was all they ever said to me was, keep coming back, keep coming back. And I said, they really must like what I say, you know. I didn't understand until later, until I started saying to my sponsors, keep coming. Throw me some of this great wisdom, and I said, yeah, okay, keep coming back, I don't know. We'll look at that through another eye a little later on. That's the story. That's the big story. But then one day, when we took David to that psychiatrist, I began to understand that I needed more than a surface program. And I'd been in that program for about, I've been in Al-Anon then for, I guess, close to 15 years, would you believe it? Close to 15 years. The good news was it kept coming back. The good news was not many people listened to me. That was the other good. The other good news was that in spite of me, a lot of people I sponsored got well. You know, isn't that interesting? In spite of me, and that has always kept my ego intact, in spite of me, and often, even when I wasn't aware of it, God uses broken people. Isn't that the good news? Why else would they ask me to come here and speak? You know, I mean, that kind of keeps you. They ask us to come here and speak, not because we're some gurus or because we have this thing all together. They want us to keep repeating the story because people like me forget. And all at once, I'll be sitting up in that condo in Chicago looking around and I'm living pretty good. I say, well, I got here all by myself. I don't think so. And if you want to stay here, you better keep going to meetings. You know? I began to look at myself and I realized that I really am powerless. You know, there's nothing wrong with being not having power. There really isn't. I realized that as the children grew up and they wouldn't do the things that I wanted them to do, they wouldn't be cute for me, they wouldn't, you know, do all these little, I couldn't show their report cards anymore. All A's, looking here, I look over here, well, what? You did what? You skipped how many diets? You what was that alcohol in your closet? My child? Who grew up, I mean, her, when she played house, other kids played house, she played going to meetings. You know, everybody down there, meeting me on the porch. My child had alcohol in her closet? You know, what are we talking about? You know, I said to my sponsor, she said, John, you got to work on you. And I said, but I can't. Let me tell you what's going on in the house right now. She said, when you're on the airplane and they say there's going to be a crash, they say, put the oxygen on yourself first and then on the other people. And I carried this sense of responsibility. But if I had been saner soon, if I had got my act together earlier, they wouldn't have to suffer the repercussions of this and this and this and this. Listen, I had to learn it's their life. The best thing I do for my children is to live what I talk today. The best thing I do for my children is not what I say, but how I walk. If I walk this life, then I have a better chance of seeing recovery in them. And so I was willing to throw up my hands and say, God, I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it anymore. And I have seen enough people in these rooms who were as equally crazy as me get better. And I knew if God could do that for them, if he could put those broken lives together, there was hope for me. So I waddled into these meetings saying, as always, this big fat of gross, just so full of self-loathing. How come I couldn't get it together one day? And I discovered that I also had an eating disorder, and I stopped eating sugar and refined flour, and it was like turning a light on in my life, you know. It was like saying, wait a minute, maybe I can be fixed. And I turned my will and my life and my choices and my children and everything else in my life over to the care of God, and I took inventory. I looked at me and I realized the broken places in my life, and I realized beyond a shadow of a doubt that the God of my understanding that I found in these rooms wanted to heal me. You know, that I wasn't just a joke, that I was more than that. I was a significant human being, and that God loved me and loved me like I was the only person in the world. Just loved me, and had waited so long for me to begin to love myself. Remember my sponsor kept saying, okay, look in the mirror and tell yourself that you're a beautiful woman. I said, well, I can't say a beautiful woman. Of course, I'm hanging out like this. And you know, I began to see a reflection of God in myself. That I am a beautiful woman. I'm a child of God. I don't care what Peter said or what the children said. I mean, they pointed out my flaws here and there. I remember once we took David and Alma to see Lena Horne, and it was my 50th birthday, Lena Horne's 70th birthday. And I said, boy, I want to look like that when I get 70. David said, no, you don't look like that now. You watch yourself, kid. You know? But by that time, I had enough recovery that I could smile. It wasn't a big, you know, yeah, okay, whatever, but I look good for how old I am, you know. I could say that, and I felt good about myself. I began to understand that these steps were about making a way for me, but even more than that is that God wanted a way for me, you know. He wanted me to get some healing in my life so that I could become a champ, you know. Not just for me, but because I could tell other people who've been broken and hurt that it's possible to put your life together again. I don't care where you are, how hurt you are, what your story is, and I don't care what you've done, nothing is too bad for God to fix. Just nothing, you know? So I kept working those steps in my life, got the sixth and seventh. One of the things that made me understand that the seventh step worked was one of my church defects was jealousy. I was so jealous. My husband's a good-looking man. I mean, seriously good-looking. I mean, he's had it, man. You know, I remember we were in New York. We were going to see some plays, and he was waiting for me in the corner. And some people came up to ask him if he modeled, you know, and if he could come. He said, yes, and my wife would come along. And I waddled up to him. They changed their mind. But anyway, that was then. They would have taken me for 25 years, I like to say. But anyway, women were always calling. Now, I'm not saying that my husband was perfect. I'm not saying that all my feelings that he was not faithful or he was not, were all part of my disease. I think he had some problems. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was what was going on in me. my feelings. I remember we had gone to, he was directing a health care center. He had really progressed and gone back to school and got some degrees. He was doing really well. Anyway, he was directing this health center and we were entertaining his staff. And he had told me the week before that he had hired a new secretary. But he said she was an older woman. And I said, that's very nice. Well, we were standing there and this woman in this mini skirt sashayed up to me and said, Mrs. Crawford, I'm your husband's new secretary. And I saw Peter across the room making a beeline towards me. And he was kind of dragging me out of and he kept saying she didn't look like that when I hired her. This woman had had a transformation in still less than a week. Anyway, I remember just being so angry on my way home. What you said, and then this, and this, and this. And Peter said, Dawn, do you think it has anything to do with your low self-esteem? Well, he hit on something. I remember calling my sponsor and I said, let me tell you what he said. And she said, well, does it? She said, why don't you pray about that? You know, it seems to come up a lot in your life. Why don't you pray about that? And I said, I've tried every means in the world. She said, well, why don't you ask God to lift that character defect? Maybe it's getting in your way of being a good servant. And I remember praying about that and praying about that. We went to a conference about 2 months later. We were standing at a conference, and my husband was standing over in the corner, and there was a whole lot of nice-looking women all standing around. Now, let me say this nice-looking. These women could have been 90 years old. I started to say 70, but now I'm 70, so I wouldn't say that anymore. These women could have been 90 years old. You know, I would have said the same thing. But he was standing over in the corner talking to these women, and you know what? I didn't feel a thing in my heart but love for him. God did that. God did that. God lifted those feelings and those emotions and changed this person inside. I was free to love them and love Peter. That's a miracle. And I feel God could do that. He could do anything in my life. I could give him a little more of this and a little more of that and more and more and more until I could sing in the shower each morning, I surrender all. I surrender all. Anything that stands in the way of my relationship with God, I don't want it today. I don't want it today. Now, that doesn't mean I've reached a stage of perfection. That means I don't want it today. And I know that if something comes up, I know where to go with it. You know, I started trying to make amends to those children. In particular, I had this rage I carried in me so long for my grandfather. You know, the things that he had done to me, I just was so angry. The problem was my grandfather was dead, and I was living the anger. And who was being hurt but those who were around me and myself? And I remember asking God, whatever it is, just help me with it. And I looked at my grandfather through a spiritual eye, and I realized my grandfather had been a slave. He'd been brutalized in his life. He had a really horrendous story. And my grandfather was a sick old man. And beyond that, I still loved my grandfather. And it was like just a sense of forgiveness and love that came over me. That man who took advantage of me, I wanted to get rid of him. If I could have found him at any given time in my early recovery, I would have found a gun and shot his genitals. Just his genitals. But don't do it in the spiritual way. But nevertheless, you know, when I looked at that man through a spiritual eye and realized the damage in his soul and realized had it not been for him, I would have never had that older son. And 20 years ago, I was reunited with that boy and he became a part of my life. And I have two beautiful grandchildren by him. What a gift. What a gift. God has been so good to me. Those children that I really just messed up in front of, I said, okay, now I'm going to have a chance. I'm living this program. And every time they come to me, I'm going to come. I'm going to give them the great answer. I'm going to be just Miss Wonderful. That's my favorite thing to say to my children. Anyhow, I don't know.
Tell me how you work that out. You know, because I really don't know. I don't know. I don't really answer to many things in life. All I know is that God is faithful. Lisa came to me and said, there's something I ought to tell you about myself. And I said, what is it, Lisa? I was ready. I thought she was going to say, I'm pregnant. And I said, I'll be a good mom to her, you know, because I couldn't go to my mother. And she said, I'm gay. And I said, no, you're not. And Lisa left for a while. I didn't know where Lisa was. Lisa was gone. Lisa lived in, she lived in California. She lived in Boise, Idaho. She lived in Philadelphia. She lived in, I don't know how many places. And one night we got the call, and Lisa said, Mom, I'm suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And so was my partner. And she said, we need to come home and get sober. And my sponsor said, you read the big book, Dawn. You read 448 because you're going to get a call one day, and you need to be ready. And when she called and said she wanted to come home, I said, you come on home, Lisa. And she brought her partner. And they celebrated 19 years of sobriety in these rooms. You know? God has a way of using situations to transform and change our lives. And then old Alma. Alma was the child that, she's the child that my mother used to say, you know, I hope one day you have a child that's just like you. That's dangerous. Don't ever say that to your children. I got Alma. Alma was a child. I remember thanking her. She's about 2 years, 3 years old. And she'd done something. And she said, it's too bad that a big lady like you has to hit a little girl like me. And she was right. You know, I should have been able to reason with a two-year-old, you know. But for some reason, I didn't know we were on the same wavelength. But she was a challenge. She always was a challenge to me. She did things that she just amazed me with her. First place, she was smarter than I was. It's very difficult to have a child that's smarter than you are. She was smarter than me, and I think that she looked down in many ways on my inability to deal with situations. It's interesting. Now she thinks I'm a giant, you know. But this was at teenage years, you know. She was really something. And I remember that coming home from church one day, this man. No, let me tell you about Elma first. Elma, she got this job. She quit school. Peter and I had gone through this period where Peter lost his job. We were doing pretty good then. We had a big house. I think got a tremendous sense of humor. He lost his house. I'm working my program. He's working his program. He lost his job and we lost our home. We went from the having help in the house to losing the house to being on food stamps. It was a really hard time in our life. The interesting thing was my program got better, and so did Peter's. It was like God stripped us of things and gave us grace. You know, it was a very important time. For 2 years, Peter was out of work, and I ended up going to work, which was a blessing. You know, I never thought. It was like God said to me, get up off your whatever. And go on and get a job, you know? There's one of those, you know that meditation in one of our, I think it was Odette Brooks, where this woman who has her foot on the man's neck and she can't understand why he can't stand up on his feet, you know? And it's just, whoa! wonder who they're talking about. Anyway, I went and got this job and I saved all my money from the job so I could send this girl to college, and she came home from college and said that she decided that she didn't want to be there anymore, that what she was going to do. She had found herself, and Peter and I were looking at one another, and she said, I'm going to be a waitress. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a waitress. It's that this child had never helped anywhere at home. She never cleared the table. And I said, how is she going to be a waitress? And I said, well, you just go out there, honey, and you be a good waitress. And then Peter went to his meeting, and I went to my meeting. And we went down to where she was waiting tables, and I've never seen a waitress like that in my life. Never. I ordered one thing. She brought something else. Now, a man at the table next to me said, this is the worst waitress I have ever seen in my life. Alma said, if you want better service, go to a better place. It was just amazing. We didn't leave a tip. That's how bad it was. This was our own tip. We just got up and left, you know. I never forget, also, she had this boyfriend. This boyfriend, she said, I want you to meet my boyfriend. And Peter and I got, you know, we're geared up. Okay, here she comes. Work program, like lights going off. Work program. Al-Anon must be forefront. Here came this man who was the same age as my husband. And he looked terrible. We took him out to dinner, and he said, it's all right, Mrs. Crawford. I'll pay the tip.
And Alma was waiting for us to say something about him negative. We said, that is the nice man. Well, 2 weeks, it was over. Now, if I had said something, that relationship would have ended up in a marriage. 4 children, you know, on welfare. Who knows? But anyway, she decided it wasn't enough. But then Alma decided one day, she was standing waiting for a bus, and this man put a knife in my daughter's neck, dragged her off into an alley, and raped her. And I remember going to be with Alma, and the good news was I had worked my stuff through in these rooms. So I could go and just put my arms around my daughter and nurture her and love her and be there for her. And I watched her grow and watched her grow. She decided she'd get a job. She got a job working for National Public Radio, and she was doing just great. I was so proud of her, you know. And she got a job working for... She was the director of education for the Catholic something, and she's not a Catholic, so I said, well, this is very interesting. But she's our child. She's a seeker. She's a seeker. And then she came and went away to Boston and studied for a year at the Women's Episcopal Seminary and came back and finished her undergraduate degree. And we were with her as she got a master's in divinity and as she was ordained in the United Church of Christ. And Alma pastors a church in Chicago. And Alma, too, is gay. And Alma is one of the most delightful women I have ever known in my life. Alma is a source of strength to me. Who would have thought this kid that drove me up a wall, that all I had to learn to do was love her unconditionally, and she would turn out to be such joy to me. You know? 2.5 years ago, Alma adopted this little baby. She got the call. And she said, Mom, I don't want a baby that's been drug addicted. It's just too hard. And I'm pastoring, and her partner's pastoring, and they just wouldn't be able to manage it. And so they went up to this kind of desolate city, and they got this little baby, and they put the baby in her arms. And there was one report that was missing. But Alma got the baby home. And when she got the baby home, she found out that the baby's mother was drug addicted. But by that time, Alma had the baby in her arms. And that baby is the joy of my life. That baby brings me so much sunshine. The baby pats me on the head and says, you know, Zaba's old, you know. And I said, that's right. I'm crawling around the floor and I can't get up. And I said, help Zaba up. You know, it's such a joy. And we have walked through so many things. And my children have come to be a blessing to me. My son David. David was my heart, you know. David was that little boy that I remember pushing him in the cart in the supermarket, and the lady said, you're the prettiest little boy I've saw in my life. And David said, you're the funniest looking lady. So, okay. David used to sing. He would sing, and he had this beautiful voice, and people would come up to me and say, is he the one? And I said, I don't know. I'd seen him at home, and I knew better, but I didn't want to discourage him. But he was just such a blessed child to me. And I just love David. I don't know how to express to you when David was born, it was like God gave me back the son I had lost early in my life. And so when they laid David in my arms, he was just a blessing. Well, 10 years ago, David told me that he was gay and he had HIV, you know. And I said, well, let's make the best of what you have, David. I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose you because I'm not ready to lose a child, you know. And so we had a marvelous 10 years. I mean, we had a great year. We went to the conventions together. He came out here. You know, David was not, I never saw David drunk, but I do remember that he called one night, it's like at 12 midnight, and he was coming out. He said, Mom, I'm in a bar, and I think I've had one of your miracles. He said, I'm drunk. I said, David, you're drunk? He said, yeah. And he said, this man came out of the stall next to me, and I said, I'm so drunk, I don't know my name. And the man said, well, you don't have to live like that. He said, I'll take you to a 12-step program. I never thought that God would meet my son in a bar, in a 12-step program, and take my son. God is so gracious. God is so gracious. Well, 4 years ago, I got a call. I was with Alma, who was sick, and Peter said, we have to put David in the hospital. And so I took a plane home.
And I got to the hospital, and I looked at him, and David said, "Mom, you think this is it?" I said, "Oh, no, David. But for 11 days, we stayed around that hospital bed. We sang songs, we sang hymns. Lisa, every once in a while, he'd say, "Close the door," and Lisa would sing, "There's a balm in Gilead that heals the sin-sick soul." No. It heals. We didn't use sin-sick, because I don't like that. It heals to heal the wounded soul. No. And we would just sing. We'd have a wonderful time in that room. And one night, the doctor came and he said, "David said that you and Lisa are to make the decision." He said, "He can last a few more days, but he's in so much pain. We're going to up the morphine. He'll probably go tonight." And I went back in the room and I talked with David. And I said, "David, you know what's going on?" And he said, "No." And he said, "Mama, if I could have loved anybody one-tenth as much as you've loved me, it would be enough." He said, "I've said goodbye to everybody." He said, "It's okay." And they upped the morphine, and we sat around his bed. And we had prayer together, and I sang the song I sang to him when he was in my arms as a little baby. And I said, "It's okay to go now, David. It's okay." And within 10 minutes, David was gone. David was gone, but not really. Not really. Because in these rooms and in the meetings I go, every once in a while, some young man or some boy or some older man will come up, and he's in recovery or he's hurting, and I see David in him. And I can open my arms and say, "Welcome home." I decided a couple of weeks ago I needed to go and get a massage. You know, I moved to Chicago and I was just feeling, just needed a massage. And I went in this room and this guy was standing there and he had David's eyes, you know. And I said, "Wow." And I said, "Listen, this is not about you, but I'm going to weep through this massage if you don't mind." And I did. I wept through it. You know, I just wept through it. And I thanked God for the privilege of having David as my son for 33 years. What a gift. What a gift. And we got finished. I asked the guy, you know, getting ready to pay him. And he said, "No charge for you." You know, he said, "This was more healing for me than it was for you." God is so good. I never know where the blessing's going to be that I get from these rooms. You know, 20 months ago, old Peter died. We had 44 years, 10 months, and 12 days together. I'm not good talking about this yet, but I'm getting better. Peter was my buddy, you know. We had grown through a lot of pain and a lot of anger and a lot of resentment and a lot of self-pity and all that stuff that we came into this broken relationship. It shouldn't have worked. The votes were that it would last 6 months, and it lasted all that time. But God had transformed him and changed me. I remember thinking, if I ever get myself together, I'm out of here. And I began to get myself together, and Peter began to get himself together, and lo and behold, I fell in love with that man. I loved him so much. You know. And we took him to the hospice. He'd been in hospice care at home. And I've been taking care of him for 3 years. I was so tired. And my daughter said, "You just need a little break, Mama." And so we put him in the hospice. And as we got to the door, my husband said, I saw David standing in the corner waiting for me. God is so merciful. You know, Peter had absolutely no fear of death because he saw his son standing over there in the corner at the hospice waiting for him. And we sat around his bed for 2 days and we sang and we did hymns and Elmer read scriptures. And I told him, "Honey, it's okay. I can stand on my own 2 feet now. This program has healed me, and I thank you so much for introducing me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and making me see miracles every day of my life."
thank you for this journey. And we had a journey. I mean, we had a journey. We laughed together. And Peter could make me laugh when nobody else. He was so great that one day he was dying and he wanted the undertaker to come. So the undertaker came to the house. We were at the house when the undertaker came. And Peter said, well, here's what I want done. And he gave this man this long list of things. And when the man left, Peter said, I don't know whether I can work with him. I said, no, you don't have to. I'm the one that must work. He said, oh, I kept forgetting I'm dying. Don't you love him? Don't you love him? You know, at the funeral, we had this, he was here in his casket, open casket. We had a great meeting. I mean, we had a great meeting. People were sharing. They shared how you'd hang up on them on the phone and say, are you working your program? If you're not working your program, call me back after you work this and so step, whatever one he said, then call me back. They would talk about recovery. Stop slivering and running. He was great, you know. But this man, I just knew before they closed that door, he was going to lean up and say, my turn. He said, something. The meeting's not over until I speak. But Alma preached his sermon, and I have never heard her preach like she preached. She preaches sermon. You've never heard AA people from all different walks of life saying, amen, amen. You know, it was really experienced. Lisa Spang, my oldest son from my son was there. It was a joyous occasion. It was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous going home sober. Isn't that something? This program is wonderful. So where am I now? You know, I'm a 70-year-old woman, bought a condo in Chicago, living over my daughter, learning once again how to keep my mouth shut and have boundaries, you know, loving every moment of it. Miss Peter terribly, making decisions all on my own and saying, you probably wouldn't have liked this, Peter, but I like it. You know, you know, I'm having a wonderful time. And the good news is I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that one day I will see Peter Crawford again. And we will sit around those tables up there. And I know that the subject is going to be gratitude, because we have so much to be grateful for what God did in our life and what we've seen him do in your life. You know, I don't know where you are in this program. I don't know whether you suffer from terminal uniqueness, you know. I don't know whether you think your case is worse than any other case. There is nothing that God can't heal. God loves us just like we are and is in the business of transforming and bringing all kinds of blessings. It's all about the joy of living. Don't miss an opportunity out here. Tell somebody you love them, you know. Don't be afraid of what their response, because who cares what they think? It's what we feel inside us. And that little grandbaby can come up and throw those old dirty arms around me no matter what she's been doing. And she knows it doesn't matter if I am on my best suit or what. She can do it. She can wipe snot on my clothes. I don't care. Because she is my grandbaby. You know, God feels the same way about us. I don't care where we've been. God just wants to open these arms and say, pick up those steps. Pick them up and use them. That's what it's all about. Oh, there's a hymn. I'm tired. It's like I've been preaching. Oh, please, Lord. I am my father's child. I swear I am. There's a hymn that I like to end with that says, pardon from sin and a peace that endures. Thine own dear presence to heal and to guide. Strength for today and great hope for tomorrow. Blessings are ours and 10,000 beside. Great is thy faithfulness. Great is thy faithfulness. Morning by morning, new mercies I see. All I have needed, not wanted, but all I have needed, God's hand has provided. Great is God's faithfulness to you
you. Into you. Into you. Thank you.